Here we go. Hey, welcome to Real Liberty Media. This is Vincent Easley. I'm going to be speaking today, reading that is, and let me give you the title here. This is part of the radio reading series, and Bundy et al., The Dismissal with Prejudice, The Appeal, and The Government's Reply, Their Brief. I'm taking this from seditionist.com, Bundy Appeal, 105 PDF. It is case number 18-10-287-118-2019. ID is 11493829. DK entry 105, page 1 of 44, where I start. This is case number 18-10-287. DC number is 216 CR46 GMN. There's a lot of be reference in here in citation, and instead of reading those in abbreviation out as I go along, I'll just say citation or reference. This comes in. Let me make sure I got my recording going. Here are good. Yeah, I've got levels. Okay. This is in the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. The United States of America Plaintiff Appellate versus Cliven D. Bundy, Ryan C. Bundy, Ammon E. Bundy, and Ryan W. Payne, Defendants Appellees. On appeal from the United States District Court from the District of Nevada, Government's Reply Brief. It comes from Nicholas A. Trotnick, U.S. United States Attorney, Elizabeth O. White, Appellate Chief and Assistant U.S. Attorney, District of Nevada. Her address listed in Reno, Nevada. And those are the attorneys for the United States. The date submitted, November the 8th of 2019. We have table of contents. We have one, introduction. Two, reply argument, that being A, the timing of the government's disclosure did not constitute flagrant misconduct and defendants' attempts to defend parts of the district court's analysis fail, page 3. Therein, one, Payne and Ammon Bundy concede the maps were duplicative, page 4. Two, Payne and Ammon Bundy connection that the Felix supplemental 302 contain new relevant information that it is meritless. Three is defendants do not rebuke the government's argument that its failure to disclose the Demolino supplemental 302 and Raker 302 earlier was reasonable, or that the district court erred in finding flagrant misconduct with respect to those disclosures. Page 8. Under that is A. In light of the district's court prior ruling, the government's failure to appreciate the potential relevance of evidence regarding armed law enforcement officers near the Bundy residence was not unreasonable, and in any event, these documents were duplicative. Page 9. B. Defendants make no attempt to defend the district court's equating FBI authorship with flagrant misconduct. Page 12. 4. Defendants do not rebuke the government's argument that its failure to find the Desert Tortoise report earlier did not constitute flagrant misconduct. Page 13. Defendants do not dispute the prosecutors produced the TOC log as soon as they learned about it and do not rebuke the government's argument that their failure to learn of it earlier was not unreasonable. Excuse me, page 15. 6. Defendants suffered no prejudice from the government's failure to disclose earlier additional information about the camera, page 19. 7. Defendants do not rebuke the government's argument that its production of the 2012 threat assessment did not constitute flagrant misconduct or cause substantial prejudice. Page 22. And part B. The court should reject the defendant's attempt to inject confusing untested and merit issues into this appeal. Page 24. 1. The district court correctly rejected the defendant's numerous accusations of discovery violations. Page 24. The government properly opposed and the court correctly rejected Payne's request for earlier Jinks Act and expert witness disclosures. Page 25. B. The government properly opposed and the court correctly denied Ryan Payne's motion to compel disclosure regarding mysterious devices near the Bundy residence. Page 27. C. The government constantly sought and followed the district court's guidance regarding disclosure of allegations that a BLM agent engaged in unrelated acts of misconduct many months after the assault, and the district court explicitly found no Brady violations with respect to those disclosures. Page 28. And that's in 3. 2. The court should not consider the untested Wooten allegations in this appeal because the defendants insisted the district court not hold a hearing on the matter, and those allegations were not a basis for the court's ruling. Page 30. Underneath, Ryan Bundy's accusation that the government withheld the Wooten memo is meritless. Page 30. And B, the court should reject defendant's attempt to tarnish the government on appeal with accusations they insisted the district court not subject to adversarial testing, and deny the request to inject this issue into this appeal. Page 32. 3. As the district court correctly found, no double jeopardy bar exists. Page 35. 3 is the conclusion at page 38 and certificate of compliance. That's 4. We come to page 5 of 44. We have table of authorities. And let me pause a moment. Okay, here is page 5 of 44. It's a table of authorities. It cites federal cases, and the list is long. And this will be this link will be included in this broadcast, and you can come back and read all those there for yourself for brevity. We'll go to page 6, number 1, the introduction. In its opening brief, the government described the extraordinary efforts prosecutors took to review and produce thousands of items of discovery while seeking to protect victims and witnesses from threats and violence. Oops, I hit my button and went back up. Sorry. Hold on. Get back down here. All right. Saying to protect from threats and violence. We argued that any missteps with respect to disclosure of Brady materials were at worst negligent and did not warrant the extreme sanction of dismissal with prejudice. We discussed the documents on which the court based the dismissal and showed that each was either duplicative of previously disclosed material unknown to the prosecutors or based on the district court's prior ruling, unreasonably understood by the government to be irrelevant. Defendants do not rebuke and largely fail to even address these arguments. Instead, they seek to inject numerous other issues unrelated to the decision on appeal. They re-raise baseless allegations of misconduct that the district court rejected, including one allegation the court generously found not necessarily in bad faith, but rather premised on defendant's ignorance. They asked this court to consider sensational, untested accusations that they urged the district court not to investigate, that they highlight misconduct finding against the BLM agent that played no role in the court's decision, and they re-raise a double jeopardy argument. The district court explicitly and correctly rejected. Page one. This is page seven. That was one in there. Okay. The court should reject defendant's attempt to obfuscate the issue in this appeal. As the court has made clear, a district court's discretion to dismiss an indictment with prejudice is exceedingly limited. A court does not have discretion to dismiss an indictment with prejudice unless the government's misconduct was so grossly shocking and outrageous as to violate the universal sense of justice, or where the government's misconduct was flagrant and caused substantial prejudice, and no less a remedy is possible to cure that prejudice. The district court here abused its limited discretion. Its finding of flagrant misconduct rested on mistaken assumptions about how the produced documents related to previously produced discovery, a legally erroneous equating of non-disclosure with flagrant misconduct, and a failure to appreciate how some of the government's discovery decisions, even if erroneous, were reasonable in light of the court's prior ruling. Thus, even assuming the district court correctly found a Brady violation with respect to one or more documents, the extraordinary section of dismissal with prejudice was unwarranted and exceeded the court's limited discretion. The court's condemnation of the prosecution team was undeserved, and less drastic remedies were available. The court should reverse. There's two. Now, part two, reply argument. This is part A. The timing of the government's disclosure did not constitute flagrant misconduct, and defendants' attempt to defend parts of the district court's analysis fail. Wherein? The district court based its dismissal on the government's disclosure of about 80 pages of documents, including maps, FBI 302s, a BLM report about the Mojave Desert Tortoise, an administrative log from the FBI's Tactical Operations Center, known forth as TOC, two documents mentioning a surveillance camera, and threat assessments prepared for an unexecuted 2012 impoundment. Reference 1. In its opening brief, the government explained that the maps and the 302s were duplicative of previously disclosed information, and thus our late disclosure of those additional documents was neither flagrant nor substantially prejudicial. That our ability to locate the Desert Tortoise report or learn about the TOC log earlier was not unreasonable and did not demonstrate outrageous government misconduct, and in our failure to appreciate the possible relevance of two documents mentioning the camera and the threat. Pause here. There's your reference. First one, number one, is about Ryan and Ammon Bundy claimed that the government disclosed approximately 3,300 pages of discovery after the deadline for disclosing Brady evidence. And the district court found a substantial portion of these documents favorable to the defendants. District court listing favorable documents which comprise no more than 81 pages. That's in brief. There's more there. You can read for go find for yourself. Come back here. Here's page 9 of 44. Continuing from mentioned the camera and the threat assessments was reasonable in light of previous court rulings. The defendant's limited attempts to defend parts of the district court's analysis failed. 1. Payne and Ammon Bundy concede the maps were duplicative. As the government explained, OB 31 to 33, the maps we disclosed in December 2017, duplicated maps we produced in June 2016. Payne and Ammon Bundy explicitly concede this point. Reference, the government is correct from Payne. They assert, however, that the meaning of the drop points on the maps did not become clear until after the defendants received all of the late discovery from the IBID. But even if later disclosures were necessary to understand the meaning of the drop points, an assertion the government disputes, e.g., onto citation, explained explanation of drop points and description of nighttime LPOPs, maps showing drop points were discovered in June 2016, and thus disclosure of duplicative maps 18 months later could not prejudice the defense. In light of defendant's concession, the district court clearly erred in relying on the disclosure of the duplicative maps as flagrant misconduct, supporting dismissal with prejudice of the indictment. Reference two was Payne and Ammon Bundy assert the government only addressed prejudice with respect to the surveillance camera and related reports. And they say that this is incorrect. A lot of citation there. Let's pause just for a moment. Part two, Payne and Ammon Bundy's contention that the Felix Supplemental 302 contained new relevant information is meritless. As we explained, OB 33 to 35, BLM Rangers Brunk and Russell's tactical overwatch position during Dave Bundy's arrest was uncontested and well documented through timely discovery and earlier testimony. Citations there concerning Brunk's testimony. Our later disclosure of a supplemental 302 documenting Officer Felix's observation of Brunk or Russell in that position provided no new information on the point. See citation. Payne and Ammon Bundy acknowledged that the government timely disclosed the earlier information, reference for Payne. But they argue that these earlier disclosures did not relieve the government from its responsibility to disclose the Felix Supplemental 302 and imply the Supplemental 302 is important because information in it conflicts with a 302 documenting Felix's initial interview. Both points, they say, are red herrings. First, defendants do not explain why the government was required to disclose the Felix Supplemental 302. There's a reference here, Moore versus Illinois,
I'm going to pause the recording anyways. I see I dropped off.
Okay, fell off there just for a second. I'll come back in at Moore versus Illinois, 1972, wherein they say, we know of no constitutional requirement that the prosecution make a complete and detailed accounting to the defense of all police investigatory work. Although the district court repeatedly stated the 302 showed Felix's observing the listening post and observation post, that's LPOPs, we're on page 11. Thank you, Don. I'm still on the air. Good. I didn't lose air. Okay, and then there's some reference there in that finding, which Payne and Ammon Bundy explicitly repeat. See Payne reference the 35. They say is clearly erroneous. On to say, in fact, the documented summarized Felix's observation during Dave Bundy's arrest, which was nowhere near the Bundy household and had nothing to do with the LPO piece. Second, although the paragraph in the Felix Supplemental 302 describing where he was during Dave Bundy's arrest conflicts with the incorrect one-sentence description in his initial 302. There's reference. That irrelevant discrepancy or correction, they say, with a footnote of number 3 there, was not the basis of which Payne claimed relevant on the supplemental 302. Payne's sole contention was the supplemental 302 regarding Felix's observing a BLM officer in tactical overwatch position on April 6, 2014. That is referring to BLM Rangers Brunk or Russell during the Dave Bundy arrest, emphasis added. It was relevant because it, bolstered the notion that snipers were in the area and that Bundy and the Bundy household was surrounded, said the CR 3027 at 19N8. But as we explained, they say Payne's own description of the 302 makes clear he was already aware of Bunk and Russell's tactical overwatch position during Dave Bundy's arrest, and this duplicative account was unnecessary to bolster that uncontested point. The reference there is 3, back up one page back. It says, as the government elsewhere demonstrated, when officers are interviewed, they are sometimes asked to review reports of earlier interviews and correct any errors. Okay, and back to page 12. Page 12 of 44. And on about Dave Bundy's arrest. Finally, they say, defendants do not attempt to defend the district court's clearly erroneous finding that the December 27 disclosure of the Felix Supplemental 302 was prejudicial based on defense representations that they would have proposed different questions for the jury via Dyer. Let's see if I can say that right. Weir Dyer. I believe, exercised their challenges differently and provided a stronger opening statement. See more of this referenced citation there. As defendants made no such representations with respect to this document because Brunk and Russell's tactical overwatch position was well known, disclosed, and uncontested, the district court clearly erred in relying on Felix's supplemental 302 as flagrant misconduct, misconduct supporting dismissing the indictment with prejudice. And there's the reference. 4 says, although defendants made such representations with respect to other documents, their claim that if only they had received the documents earlier, then they would have sought jurors who were open to allegations of government overreaching, infiltration, and wrongdoing. It says to strain credulity, given that this was defendant's strategy from the beginning. In any event, defendants cite no authority finding a mid-trial Brady violation prejudicial based on lost opportunities in jury selection, and the government is aware of none. See United States versus Chapman. And on to noting that the appropriate remedy for Brady Giglio violations will usually be a new trial. Part 3, page 13 of 44. Defendants do not rebuke the government's argument that its failure to disclose the Demolino Supplemental 302 and the Racker 302 earlier was reasonable, or that the district court erred in finding flagrant misconduct with respect to those disclosures. The district court said the Del Molino Supplemental 302 was potentially exculpatory because it provides information regarding BLM individuals wearing tactical gear, not plain clothes, and carrying AR-15s. And it found the suppression of that 302 and the Racker 302 was a willful failure to disclose because the FBI created those these documents. There's a citation and emphasis added. Defendants do not rebut the government's argument that those findings were erroneous. Reference here at 5 and 6. 5, as we explained, OB 37 to 38, we had already produced significant discovery about these matters, and 6 was Payne and Ammon Bundy accused the government of erroneously suggesting the district court did not have these documents before ruling because the government provided them as exhibits to its December 29, 2017 pleading. See Payne, BR 82 M 13, citing OB 63. But with this one incorrectly drafted exception, see OB 29, the government's complaint was that the court did not have those documents or the maps or Desert Tortoise report when it granted the mistrial on December 20th. See OB 23, 32, 34, 40, 62 to 63. And that is 8. And on to page 14 of 44 at the top is A. In light of the district court's prior ruling, the government's failure to appreciate the potential relevance of evidence regarding armed law enforcement officers near the Bundy residence was not unreasonable. In any event, these documents were duplicative. Before trial, the district court repeatedly ruled what law enforcement officers wore and what weapons they carried was not relevant to any available defense. It was not until a week after jury selection began that defendants claimed the evidence could refute allegations that they falsely said Bundy property was surrounded by BLM snipers. I was in court during this, so I'm not going to interject. Wait, I'll just keep going. Choose that interruption. See more citations. The court acknowledged on November 8, 2017, that this new theory changed the calculus of its meritless analysis. The government disclosed the Del Molino Supplement 302 on November 7, the day before the court reversed course and found that information about the officers' uniform, their uniforms and weapons might be material to the case. To be sure, the superseding indictment. I've got to pause there. That's their secret weapon, superseding indictments. To be sure, the superseding indictment alleged that the defendant made false claims about snipers and being surrounded. But these were only 3 of more than 70 overt acts alleged. Moreover, the government's opening statement, which covers 94 pages of trial transcript, includes only a single sentence alleging that the defendant's claim of being surrounded by BLM were false. You see more there, Payne and Ammon Bundy. They quote those 3 overt acts repeatedly and make that single sentence of the government's 94-page opening statement a separate brief subheading. CID at 18. Yeah, that is. But their attempt to turn this minor aspect of the government's case into its centerpiece fails. Payne and Ammon Bundy argue the government should have appreciated the importance of these allegations because they assert the government itself argued and the indictment's allegations that defendants made false representations about BLM conduct were integral to the government. Sorry, let me find where I was at.
They start the, let me pause here just a minute. I'll come back to it. Let me see what happened. Okay, let me start again right here at Payne and Ammon Bundy argue that the government should have appreciated the importance of these allegations because, they assert, the government itself argued that the indictment's allegations that defendants made false representations about BLM conduct were integral to the government's case from day one. Comes from Payne. In support of that assertion, they cite the government's opposition to Payne's motion to strike as, let's see this word, I really didn't even, well, you can laugh at me, superseding. Okay. And to strike, I dropped down. What is this word? Superplusage. 23 paragraphs and 7 headings and subheadings from the superseding indictment. And yes, I'll have to look up how to say that word. I don't think I've seen it before. But none of the tests Payne sought to strike involved allegations that the defendants falsely claimed being surrounded by snipers. The government's opposition to the motion to strike says nothing about the import of those three overt acts to the government's case. In any event, regardless of how important or unimportant those allegations were to our case, striking them and precluding the government from introducing any evidence to support them would cure any prejudice from the timing of the disclosures. Moreover, the documents regarding the officers' uniforms and weapons, mostly focusing on the LPOPs near the Bundy residence, were duplicative of earlier discovery and defendants' complaints. Demonstrate against how they simultaneously complained about too much and too little discovery and used the government's extraordinary discovery production against it. That is page 16 of 44. Unpause. In March 2017, the government disclosed a 302 stating that BLM Ranger Terrell Bradford was assigned to an LPOP and that his duties included observations in the area of the Bundy residence, front and rear positions. It goes on with a reference there, or a citation to this. When we pointed this out, Payne complained in a November 2017 pleading that the defendants could not be held responsible for knowing what was in the discovery. Given the close to 24,000 pages of just, there was, I forget what the terabytes or whatever they had there, a phenomenal amount of information and stuff buried inside. Very tricky how they do this. I interrupt this reading here to say that. But given to the close to 24,000 pages of discovery and hundreds of hours of videotape material the government had produced. their citation. The government also produced discovery in March 2017 identifying 6 officers assigned to LPOP Night Watch during the impoundments. But in a November 2017 pleading, Payne claimed the defense did not have that information. They're decided, so we provided additional discovery about those officers, including the Racker 302, which states Racker conducted LPOP duties in the area of the Bundy Ranch for a time. Payne cited the Racker 302 in December 18, 2017, pleading six SER 1056, and without giving the government an opportunity to respond, the district court declared a mistrial in part based on it. They say this was an error.
At page 17, B, defendants make no attempt to defend the district court's equating FBI authorship with flagrant misconduct. As the government argued, see OP 36-37, the district court erred when it found a willful failure to disclose and thus flagrant misconduct based solely on the fact that the FBI created these documents because drawing these authorship willfulness nexus effectively imposes strict liability for discovery errors, virtually eliminating the possibility of inadvertent non-disclosure. Payne and Ammon Bundy's response to this argument proves our point. They argue the prosecution team has a duty to learn of any favorable evidence known to others acting on the government's behalf, including the police, citing Kyles versus Whitley, 1995. They really said it. True enough, they say. No way, they did. True enough, but the proposition means only that the prosecutor's failure to learn of such evidence can constitute a Brady violation. The court here went much further, concluding solely because the FBI created the 302s, that the government's failure to disclose them earlier was a willful failure to disclose, amounting to flagrant misconduct. The district court cited no authority supporting that authorship willfulness nexus, and defendants likewise failed to offer any. The court erred. That's their page 12 and page 18 of this 44-page document, wherein we come to number 4. Defendants do not rebuke the government's argument that its failure to find the Desert Tortoise report earlier did not constitute flagrant misconduct. Payne and Ammon Bundy assert the Desert Tortoise report contained favorable evidence, suggesting there was no documented injury to tortoises by grazing. So true. They say, but they do not explain how such evidence is favorable. They cite as a prior explanation, but what footnote simply acknowledges. I'm sorry, but that footnote simply acknowledges that the district court was incorrect in stating the report documented the fact that a BLM agent asked the FBI to place a surveillance camera, and states the defense believes the other bases cited for the finding of a Brady violation are significant. The only other basis the court articulated, however, was the report would have been useful to potentially impeach Ms. Rugwell, who testified that there had been detrimental impact on the desert tortoise habitat. This basis lacks factual and legal support. In fact, at trial, Rugwell testified by way of background that the BLM reduced the number of cattle grazing permits after the desert tortoise was listed as threatened. On cross-examination, she testified, I interrupt with reference number 7, without explanation, Clive and Bundy repeats the district court's clearly erroneous findings, C. Bundy, BR 19, even though the district court itself later recognized and corrected its clear error. On to continue about a discussion at meeting that centered around whether a cow had eaten a desert tortoise, and she said that she was not aware of that, but added that cows can adversely affect the habitat, yes, and we did have questions that found a lot of degradation of habitat in that area. So not explaining it. But I was watching this lady talking there too. Okay, more references. In Rugwell denied knowing about a purported 1990-1991 evaluation that held that held that Desert Tortoise was not threatened by cattle. It is unclear how a report suggesting there were no documented injury to tortoises by grazing could constitute impeachment information, given that Rugwell's testimony narrowly addressed degradation of habitat, reference 8. More important, it is unclear how any such evidence would be relevant. Injury to the desert tortoise or its habitat is or not an element of any crime charged. Whether Bundy's illegal grazing harmed tortoises or their habitat is irrelevant to any fact of consequence in this case. So the government's failure to locate and provide the report earlier could not have prejudiced the defense. Let me interrupt there. The whole reason that this ever ended up where it is at and in court and people that have been held at gunpoint by government people in an army of government people is because of the supposed harm to the tortoise from the cattle. let me pause just a moment and have a drink of water. Then I'm going to pause the recorder and come right back. Hold on just a minute. Yeah, I'm supposed to be reading this, not interjecting, but I am having a hard time doing that. Let me place this mic a little bit closer right here. And I'll come back in reference number 8. Yes, the report explicitly made no findings regarding the impact of trespass grazing on habitat because the court did not have the report. It was presumably relying on Payne's December 18, 2017 assertion that on November 16, 2017, Ms. Rugwell stated that grazing in the area had a detrimental impact on the desert tortoise habitat. Among these 500 pages received December 8, 2017, suggest there was no documented injury to tortoises by grazing. They're not tortoise after all. Page 20 of 44. Well, and this is, it's going to be 2 hours of reading, I reckon. Can I do it? Moreover, defendants do not even attempt to defend the district court's conclusion that the government's willfully suppressed the report and this constituted flagrant misconduct. As we explained, see OB 38 and 39, the two references began the search for the report. Both misidentified it as OIG report. Defendants request the OIG report and the government documented its diligent but unsuccessful search for that non-existent OIG report. Once we discovered the Desert Tortoise complaint, found the BLM Internal Affairs report about it, and learned that the BLM report was the so-called OIG report. We immediately produced it, along with a letter from BLM explaining why it had been so difficult to locate. Defendants offer nothing to counter these documents, confirming the government's diligent efforts. The district court's finding of willful suppression and flagrant misconduct with respect to these reports are clearly erroneous. At 5, we have defendants do not dispute that prosecution produced the TOC log as soon as they learned about it, and do not rebuke the government's argument that their failure to learn about it earlier was not unreasonable. The opening brief described how prosecution learned about the FBI's administrative log. OB 42-43, Payne and Ammon Bundy tried to defend the district court's finding that the government willfully suppressed the log, resulting in substantial prejudice to the defense, but the attempt fails. I was in there. They were suppressing it. Just about called them a bold-faced liar and idiot and everything else. You know, I've seen it. This is so legal. I guess if you write enough words, you can make it whatever you want to in legalese, but I digress. Let me try to keep reading this. They assert without exception that the TOC log revealed for the first time the government employed actual snipers close to the Bundy home. Yeah, they were denying it in court. Shut up. Just read. Payne, he said, this is correct. The Ford operating base was more than a mile away from the Bundy home, a fact the government disclosed more than a year before trial. and no FBI snipers were deployed during the impoundment operation. That's not true either. They did have, well, I don't know that they were FBI. They had certainly state police, I think. But I thought there was FBI there, too. Or some other, one of the alphabet agencies. Yeah, they had people in their scopes. That one lady, she testified. Was she state trooper? I'm sorry, I don't remember. There'll be more to come about this. Let me keep reading. The defendants claimed the TOC log provided evidence that what defendants said since April 24, 2014 was true. Actual FBI snipers were standing by close to the Bundy home, ready to respond at any moment's notice. Payne, BR-48. But the defendants did not allege the snipers were standing by, ready to respond. Rather, they maintained the BLM employed snipers against Bundy family members, and that Bundy residence was surrounded by snipers. They say neither claim is true, and the TOC log does not prove or suggest otherwise. Let me back up. Reference 9 and 10. 9. The defendants purport to describe the district findings, court's findings, combining quoted phrases from the court's ruling with their own assertion as presented. Their description implies the district court found the TOC log and directly rebutted over acts in the indictment, see Payne BR 33-34. It did not, and the district court made no such findings. And on to saying that the log would have been potentially useful to the defense to rebut the indictment over acts. Intent is, as we noted, OB 4344, officers from other agencies did assume, there you go, sniper roles at various times, which we disclosed in discovery. Don't know about that. But even assuming defendants could, here we are, halfway, page 22, but assuming defendants could have used the logs to persuade the jury that they were not lying when they made these statements, and they suffered prejudice from the timing of the disclosure, any prejudice could be remedied by striking the allegations regarding the risk calling, regarding the misrepresentations, and prohibiting the government from introducing any evidence to support these allegations. Wow. Payne and Edmund Bundy reject the obvious solution on the grounds ground that they also were also prejudiced because they were prevented from using the sniper information in opening. But the record belies their claim, and Payne asserted in his opening that he came to Nevada because he had seen pictures that looked like government snipers. And the evidence will show that snipers pointed directly at me. I had the sniper pointing at me. 200 or so armed men surrounded my home. When he tells you he was feeling surrounded and concerned for his life, talking about Clive and Bundy, it was because there was a SWAT team, because there were snipers, because there was the FBI. Defendants claimed that the government's late disclosure of the TOC, number 11, Ammon Bundy, did not make any opening statement. And disclosure of the TOC log kept them from talking about snipers, and their opening statements is simply not true, they say. I'm halfway. I'm going to stop here and take a little pause, about 5 minutes, and come back and read the other half. Resume recording here. This is page 23 at 44. Continuing. But even if the TOC log's potential usefulness to the defense means that the government's failure to disclose its earlier constituted a Brady violation, that violation alone does not justify the extreme remedy of dismissal with prejudice of the indictment. See United States versus
Toilolo 666F in the Ninth Circuit 2016, unpublished that is, and the extremely high due process dismissal standard was not met when the prosecution was sloppy, inexcusably tardy, and almost grossly negligent. Wow. That state high standard was not met here. It's not high standard. Wow. To the contrary, the court noted the government has been diligent, has tried to provide all the information that it has, and has tried to seek out any information out there that is required to be provided, and acknowledged that the log does not seem like it's something. The attorneys from the U.S. Attorney's Office would necessarily have been able to locate by any diligent means, although prosecutors have a duty to learn of favorable evidence known to law enforcement agencies acting on its behalf. The question here is whether an inadvertent or even negligent violation of that duty warrants dismissal with prejudice. This court clearly holds that it does not. See Chapman, it goes on, accidental or merely negligent government misconduct is insignificant to establish flagrant misbehavior. United States versus Kearns, Ninth Circuit, 1993, there it's the page 24 or 44. They say even negligent or grossly negligent conduct did not rise to the level of flagrant misconduct. The prosecutors in this case spent hundreds of hours reviewing, cataloging, and producing discovery. They kept meritless records of thousands of items produced, and the defendants continued to press their even broader discovery demands even as trial began. Full discovery? Is that okay? Prosecutors checked and double-checked. I wonder if they had Santa Claus there. Double-checked FBI files for information responsive to the defendant's late request and the district court's evolving conclusions regarding materiality. And in light of the court's earlier acknowledgement that the TOC log wasn't something the prosecutors would necessarily have been able to locate by any diligent means, The court's later conclusion that the prosecution team's failure to communicate or to find the TOC log earlier amounted to an intentional abdication of its responsibility and was particularly unwarranted and unfair. The court abused its discretion. Six, defendants show no prejudice from the government's failure to disclose earlier additional information about the camera. When the Bundys looked out their window in April 2014, they saw a surveillance camera. Payne and Ammon Bundy assert that the camera contributed to feelings within the Bundy home of fear and isolation. Cliven and Ryan Bundy discussed the camera during their opening statements to the jury. You're going to learn they had a camera. You will hear about, they were looking right into his house at times, seeing Cliven on the phone, talking about seeing surveillance cameras on the hills. Defendants acknowledged they were well aware of the surveillance camera, and they do not rebuke the government's argument that they suffered no prejudice from the government's failure to disclose earlier additional information about the camera. But I got to stop here. This was a big, big, long, drawn-out fight about this, and the government spit in the hands and nails. They knew it was there. I knew it was there in 2014. Everybody knew it was there. They picked it up and walked around with it. And then they get into court and try to deny that there was ever a camera one. I'm just telling you, I was there. I know. The district court's dismissal was based in part on two documents referencing the camera. One, a 302 describing an FBI agent's investigation of a lost live feed after Ryan Bundy knocked the camera over. One page in the FBI's operation work ordered that
that noted a surveillance camera with view of Bundy residence, and it goes on, neither document contained any relevant information beyond simply noting the existence of a surveillance camera with a view of Bundy residence. The camera found that evidence of a surveillance camera in its location, the proximity to the home, and that its intentional purpose was to surveil the Bundy home, potentially refutes the indictment's allegation of the defendant's deceit. I'll have to go find that fella and add this for tomorrow about that camera. Yeah, it was a high-tech sort of thing going on there. One that they denied was even getting, that anybody was even watching, that it even existed, matter of fact. And then Rugwell, she's the one who spilled the beans there. She spit it out and stumbled upon this, and pretty miraculous things happened up in that courtroom during the exculpatory hearings. I was allowed in those parts of it, but not when the jury was seated within the courtroom, because being on the exculpatory list as a witness in this case. I'm going on to read page 26. Page 26. The record belies the district court's apparent assumption that the government hid the existence of the camera. They did. Its location and its purpose. They did. In May 2016, the government disclosed to all defendants a videotaped interview in which Ryan Bundy discussed their surveillance camera and admitted knocking it over with an ATV, and has noticed about the defendants themselves, acknowledged they were aware of the camera and that it was monitoring the Bundy residence. That's reference 12. come back. Where'd you go? I hit the wrong button. It jumped on me. There's reference 12. Back up there. And I'm gonna skip the reading that. You can come back and read those if you want. I'm just gonna continue with the brief. The government argued that two documents referenced in the camera contain no duplicative information in light of the uncontested fact that defendants were aware of the camera. Defendants do not attempt to refute that argument. We got reference here of 12 and 13. Page 27. The district court also found the government's failure to produce these two documents earlier was willful because they were prepared by the FBI, and that finding of willfulness was the court's only basis for finding flagrant misconduct warranting dismissal with prejudice with respect to those documents. The government explained why these equating of authorship with willful suppression and flagrant misconduct fails as a matter of law. And reference and Payne and Ammon Bundy attempt to defend the court's rulings fails for reasons already explained. They say, back up, I hit the wrong button again. back up, where you at? Boom, boom. All right. Seven, defendants do not rebuke the government's argument that its production of the 2012 threat assessments did not constitute flagrant misconduct or cause substantial prejudice. Payne and Ammon Bundy contended the government withheld threat assessments prepared for an unexecuted 2012 impoundment, even though defense counsel requested all these threat assessments before the trial, and assert that these assessments contained favorable information that the Bundy family was not violent and desired a non-violent resolution. Absolutely true. Yeah, and they suppressed that. They did not give that over in the exculpatory evidence. You know, the FBI says, they ain't gonna be no trouble here, you know. Instead, they show up with Army 200, armed to the teeth, you know, shoot to kill and cover up. Wait a minute, I'm interjecting here. In July 2017, Payne requested all threat assessments in this case, specifying that the defense had the threat assessments provided last month. As we noted, they say 14. Okay, page 28. But we understand that there were threat assessments that took place during the impoundment. That one, and the one that was ultimately prepared by the FBI in D.C. explaining why they needed to stop operations, some emphasis added, prosecutors simply did not interpret this request as seeing assessments from a prior unexecuted impoundment. Even if they should have understood the request as seeking threat assessments prepared years earlier, their failure to do so was not unreasonable and does not meet the extremely high standard for a due process dismissal. In any event, as we explained, the government did not view the old assessments containing predictions such as the Bundys will probably get in your face but not get into a shootout, exculpatory or impeaching. And when the issue first arose at trial, the district court agreed. My recollection also was that it was the defense who elicited the information, not the government, and the information was elicited was favorable. That there was no threat, that was found as a result of that threat assessment. So it did not sound like there was any need for impeaching of her understanding of what the study found. Is that double talk? And because the threat assessment was for an impoundment that did not occur and not this current impound, did the Bundy suddenly change and become violent reapers? No. All right. So is it relevant? I'd say yeah. Because it didn't meet what you had done then? Yeah. Well, I would think so. All right. This current impoundment. Then I don't see the relevance of it being more so than any prejudicial effect that it might have on the jury. Thus, even if the government's assessment was wrong, it was not unreasonable and certainly did not constitute outrageous misconduct. B. The court should reject the defendant's attempts to inject confusing, untested, and meritless issues into this appeal. Now, I don't understand personally here how they respond to this appeal here. Where is the role of who or whom will be there to represent the Bundy et al. On the defense side? Will there be any response to the state's brief here and their filing? I don't know. This is something that I'm trying to understand. It's hard to gather this information. I'm going to tell you how this stuff works. Not a clear path for me that I've found anyways. So, number one, the district court correctly rejected defendants' numerous accusations of discovery violations. In their answering brief, Payne and Ammon Bundy reallege accusations of earlier discovery violations that the district court considered and rejected. These include claims that the government engaged in dilatory discovery tactics regarding Phase 3 discovery. See reference Ryan Bundy's request for information about the surveillance equipment and information about an investigation into a BLM special agent for unrelated acts of misconduct that occurred long after the assault in Bunkerville. And these assertions are incorrect in light of the district court's ruling and the record, and in any event could not serve as an independent basis on which to affirm the district court's dismissal with prejudice. Talking about Dan Love, he was the one in charge. He was in trouble after. He was, kill list during and all in trouble there before other cases. This guy, he's a big old bully. Dirty Dan, I call him. All right. Continue. At A, the government properly opposed and the court correctly rejected Payne's request for earlier Jinx Act and expert witnesses witness disclosures. Payne and Ammon Bundy contend that in October 2016, Payne requested certain discovery. The government balked and the court eventually ordered disclosure of this material by October the 1st of 2017, 1 month before trial. This recitation implies that the government failed. Big long reference here, and that's page 25 on their brief. Brings us to page 31 of 44. And the topic continues, short of its obligation and balked when government, when called to account, and that the court took the government to task, as the pleadings and order make clear, the characterization is inaccurate. In fact, in October 2016, a motion, Payne acknowledged the government had provided phase 1 and 2 discovery pursuant to the case management order, and provided some phase 3 discovery through the case management order, did not address it, though the case management did not address it. And he acknowledged the government had agreed to provide GINSAC and expert witness disclosures at least 30 days before trial, but he asked the court to order the government to provide GINSAC and expert witness disclosures at least 90 days before the trial, and to issue an order regarding summaries, 404B material and evidence favorable to the defense. The government responded that Payne violated the court's local rules by filing his motion without first meeting and conferring, and noted Payne had never before raised or expressed any concern about any of these requests in the motion. It reiterated it was relying on the case management order as it prepared for trial and thus opposed Payne's motion. 420 on the East Coast right now, Thursday night. Page 32. The magistrate judge agreed that the defendant should have met and conferred with the government as required by local rules, but nevertheless, entertained the motion. She rejected Payne's request for an order requiring earlier disclosure of GINSAC material, ordered the government to provide expert disclosures 30 days before trial, as we have already agreed to do, and ordered Rule 16A disclosures, most of which had already been disclosed, and Rule 16B reciprocal discovery 60 days before trial. Payne and Ammon Bundy cannot reasonably rely on this litigation as evidence of the government's dilatory discovery tactics. B. The government properly opposed and the court correctly denied Ryan Bundy's motion to compel disclosure regarding mysterious devices near the Bundy residence. Payne and Ammon Bundy also contend that the government fought disclosure of information sought by Ryan Bundy regarding every piece of equipment being used on the hills above the Bundy home. Payne, BR9. In fact, the government noted that Ryan Bundy failed to explain how the information he seeks is relevant to either the charges or defenses in the case, or how it is material to preparing a valid defense, and argued that information about surveillance cameras around the Bundy residence is immaterial to the charges in the superseding indictment. Page 33 of 44. The magistrate judge agreed denying the motion primarily because Ryan Bundy did not meet and confer before filing it as required, but also noting Bundy's failure to articulate reasoning establishing that the material he seeks are discoverable. More important, the district judge later endorsed the magistrate judge's conclusion that the relevance of information about the surveillance camera was not apparent at the time, and found no evidence of bad faith by the government. It appears from the court's order that there was no apparent or readily apparent materiality of the item requested, and so the government does not appear to have acted in bad faith by not providing that. As we argued, the district court's findings that the materiality of the information was not apparent until after the government had disclosed it negates any basis on which to find flagrant misconduct with respect to those disclosures. C. The government consistently sought and followed the district court's guidance regarding disclosure of allegations that a BLM agent engaged in unrelated acts of misconduct many months after the assault, and The district court explicitly found no Brady violations with respect to those disclosures. In December 2016, while preparing for the first trial of the Tier 3 defendants, prosecutors learned that a BLM agent who was expected to be a government witness at trial was under investigation for misconduct alleged to have occurred many months after the assault. The government submitted the matter to the district court for in-camera review in an ex parte sealed submission, and the district court advised that because the allegations were unsubstantiated, the government did not need to disclose the information to the defense. District court recounting procedural history. Over the following months, the government submitted quite a few in-camera submissions regarding the matter. After OIG issued a report sustaining the allegations, the court ordered the government to disclose unredacted copies of the report and other materials, and we did, they say. Payne immediately filed a motion to dismiss the indictment or for other relief of in light of OIG disclosures. He asserted the defense's main concern is the U.S. Attorney's concealment of the agent's misconduct, and alleged that by all indications, the U.S. Attorney had no intention of revealing anything about it, the agent's OIG investigation, or misconduct to anyone, urging dismissal of the indictment because the government's failure to meet its obligations demands a thorough remedy by the court. At a hearing on the motion, the court disabused the defendants of their faulty assumptions. It noted five ex parte government submissions and related orders and stated it does not agree that there has been any Brady violations or a series of Brady violations. During this sealed portion, yeah, they had a lot of sealed hearings. All kinds of stuff was kept secret. Sealed evidence, all that stuff, yeah. Sealed. During the sealed portion of that hearing, the government objected to the aspersions that had been cast its way. The court noted that the defense had not been privy to the government's ex parte submissions, and thus found Payne's motion was not necessarily in bad faith, considering they were in the dark. The court ordered the government to undertake additional review and some material, but found no basis for dismissal and reiterated that it made a finding that there was no Brady violation and that has occurred, much less a pattern of any Brady violations. I think everybody's doing the best they can faced with the information we have. Defendants' attempts to portray the issue as evidence of the government's dilatory discovery tactics is nonsensical. To the contrary, this episode is just another example of how, again and again, defendants made spurious accusations of misconduct, were set straight by the court, refused to accept the court rulings, and continue to press the same rejected accusations. Two, the court should not consider the untested Wooten allegations in this appeal because the defendants insisted the district court not hold a hearing on the matter, and those allegations were not a basis for the court's rulings. A, Ryan Bundy's accusation that the government withheld the Wooten memo is meritless. As an initial matter, Ryan Bundy accuses government of failing to provide the defense with Wooten's memos for 9 days and said this amounted to goading a mistrial. The record belies Bundy's accusation. Associate Deputy Attorney General Andrew Goldsmith received the email from Wooten on November the 27th of 2017. The Monday after Thanksgiving, and forwarded it to prosecutors November 29. Prosecutors disclosed it with a memorandum summarizing an investigation into some of Wooten's allegations to the court in camera on December 1. requesting a protective order to allow disclosure to defendants. Ibid. The court signed the protective order on December 7th. It's sealed. The U.S. Attorney's Office received the order on December 8th and immediately disclosed the email as the memorandum to the defense. Notwithstanding, is a note there in 17. We'll skip it. You read it. Come back here. Okay. Now we're at page 37 of 44. As with defendants' meritless accusation that the government withheld the OIG report regarding the BLM special agent, Ryan Bundy's misconduct allegations may simply reflect ignorance of the government's diligence in submitting the material for immediate in-camera review. In any event, his accusations is meritless. B. The court should reject defendants' attempt to tarnish the government on appeal with accusation they insisted the district court not subject to adversarial testing, and deny their request to inject this issue into this appeal. In a December 10, 2017 pleading, Payne acknowledged that the veracity of Wooten's claims could not be determined without an evidentiary hearing, and represented that the defense would be moving for such a hearing soon. Sealed, CR 2978 at 5. Defendants Clive and Bundy and Ammon Bundy filed that request the next day. At a hearing that day, Payne reiterated that he was not in a position to provide the court with what kind of accuracy the Wooten memo contains, and that to determine the veracity of the accusations, there would need to be an evidentiary hearing. Here's more from the Oregonian, December 15, 2017, available at oregon-standoff.com/Oregon-Standoff/2017/12/BLM/investigator/alleges/misco.html. That's noting prosecutors shared the memo last week after the defense lawyers for Bundy, his two sons and co-defendant, Ryan Payne, as they were in the midst of their conspiracy trial, but it's not part of the public record. Page 38. And continuing the evidentiary hearing. But when the government agreed and asked the court to schedule a hearing so Wooten's accusations could be tested, Payne reversed course and opposed the hearing, and he requested, asserting that the suggestion that Mr. Wooten come over here and give information is ridiculous. The court was justifiably confused by the about-face. The court, I thought you requested a hearing, and Payne then denied having requested the hearing. I don't think that we have a hearing. I think this case needs to be dismissed with prejudice. Thus, withstanding Payne's explicit admission that the veracity of Wooten's allegations cannot be determined without a hearing, the defense urged the district court not to hold such a hearing, and the court acceded to the reversal of position and did not schedule one. Reference 18. The court ultimately dismissed the indictment against these defendants for other reasons, which at issue in this appeal. The untested accusations of the Wooten memo were not a basis for the dismissal. On appeal, Clive and Bundy asked this court to act as a fact finder. His misnamed excerpts of record includes hundreds of pages of documents that are not, in fact, in the record. His brief presents arguments based on assumptions regarding these extra record documents, none of which has been considered or decided by the district court. In addition to making arguments to this court based on those documents, he asked this court to order a limited remand of the district court to develop Wooten's testimony. The court should deny that request. The Wooten The Wooten memo was not a basis for the dismissal ruling underlying this appeal, nor could it have been, given that as the defendants acknowledged the truth or falsity of the allegations in it are undetermined. Clive and Bundy request a limited remand to develop that issue, apparently in hopes of bolstering the rationale for the dismissal order now under review. He cites no authority for such a procedure, and the government is aware of none. If the government argues the district court erred and abused its discretion when it dismissed the case with prejudice, this court should reverse that dismissal and send the case back to the district court for further proceedings. Clive and Bundy's suggested course of action that the court retain jurisdiction over the appeal but issue a limited remand for the district court to consider other possible reasons to support its order post hoc finds no support in the law. 3. As the district court correctly found, no double jeopardy bar exists. When the defendant does not object to a declaration of mistrial, the general rule is that the double jeopardy clause is no bar to retrial because the defendant voluntarily has chosen not to have his trial completed before the first jury in panel to try him. That comes from United States versus Mondragon in 2013. Continuing citations and reference. And on to page 41. Bundy argues that the court should affirm the dismissal with prejudice on the ground that the prosecution compelled the declaration of a mistrial. Bundy and the double jeopardy bar's trial. This argument lacks merit. The district court considered and explicitly rejected this contention. Considering what has occurred throughout the trial up to this point, the court found no evidence that the government's failure to disclose evidence was a strategy decision on the prosecution's part to abort the trial. The contrary, the court noted it appears the government has attempted to provide the defense with the identified Brady evidence in order to move forward with trial and not to purposely goad the defense into moving for mistrial. Yeah, I remember that fight in there. The out-of-court district court cases Ryan Bundy cites are readily distinguishable. More reference and mostly most obviously, the courts in those cases found that the prosecutors had intentionally goaded the defendants into moving for a mistrial, whereas the court here explicitly found that the government had not. Let me pause for a moment. All right, let's see here. Here we are back. Page 42 of 44. That the government had not, in addition, in Sterba, the court found the prosecutors allowed a government witness to testify under a false name and withheld that fact and withheld Giglio material about the witnesses until the trial was nearly over. Here the motions to dismiss were prompted by the government's disclosure of potential Brady material during the very early stages of the trial. Moreover, although the district judge initially found that numerous instances of improper and inexcusable conduct in front of the jury supports an inference of goading, the court reversed its initial decision after an evidentiary hearing, finding that the prosecutor did not intentionally cause a mistrial. This is more references, citations, that is. And in any event, the Second Circuit ultimately vacated the court's order with instructions to dismiss the defendant's petition for failure to exhaust state remedies. More. Ryan Bundy argues that a remand is necessary because the district court should be afforded the opportunity to decide in the first instance whether the government's conduct goaded a mistrial. But the district court already decided that question. It explicitly and unequivocally found that the government attempted to provide the defense with the identified Brady evidence in order... let me scroll back up. I hit the end button again. Right about here. But the district court already decided that the question, it explicitly and unequivocally found that the government attempted to provide the defense with the identified Brady evidence in order to move forward with trial and not to purposely goad the defense into moving for mistrial. Ryan Bundy does not show and cannot credibly argue that the district court's finding was clearly erroneous. His claim fails. This is three, the conclusion at page 43. Conclusion, for the reasons stated above and the government's opening brief, the government respectfully requests this court reverse the district court's dismissal of the indictment and remand for further proceedings, dated this 8th day of November 2019. Nicholas A. Trutanich, Trutanich, United States Attorney. Elizabeth O. White, Appellate Chief and Assistant United States Attorney, that is A. USA. Listed address in Reno. Certificate of compliance pursuant to Fed or at P32A7C and Circuit Rule 32.1. I certify that the attached reply brief is proportionally spaced, has a typeface of 14 points, and contains 8,359 words. It therefore complies with the Fed Rule App P32A7C and Ninth Circuit Rule 32.2B, allowing an additional 1,400 words to a party replying to a longer joint brief pursuant Ninth Circuit Rule 32.2B. Elizabeth O. White, Appellate Chief and UA USA, dated November 18th, 2019. That is 39 pages that they have in their brief, and 44 of this document that I have from seditionist.com/BundyAppeal105.pdf. And this recording will be included, whether probably over in the Ponder Grander podcast player. With you'll be able to find how to come this, if you're listening now, tomorrow, Real Liberty Media, that is December the 20th at noon central in 1 p.m. Eastern time. I will be coming back to discuss further on the appeal by the state of the dismissal of Bundy et al. Dismissal by Judge Gloria Navarro with prejudice. Let me go here just a little close out. let's see what I've got here. Yes. There. The state says no fair. 2 years ago, Judge Gloria Navarro called a mistrial and tossed the federal case against the Bundys et al., calling it flagrant misconduct and that the universal sense of justice has been violated. She later ruled to dismiss the charges altogether and with prejudice, thus barring any retrial under the Double Jeopardy Clause. More tomorrow, that's right, Real Liberty Media. Come on back right here later tonight. Real Liberty Media is going to have another broadcast, the Power Hour with the Poopsters and Prince. And Prince, like stepping. All right, let me stop. Real Liberty Media, I'm Vincent Easley. That was reading the brief. And we'll, whoops. I hope it's got not that. Try to get buttons over here. Let me go stop this recording. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you on air tomorrow.